Hey, y'all. I'm getting over a cold, and I'll probably sound congested while recording this. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, and may we all have a happy new year. This podcast will be roughly divided in half between an interview that I did with a Syrian refugee before transferring to our refugee state of the union, if you will. I took the format that I experimented with last year and expanded upon it this time. I added more countries and refugee crises to the list. But first, it's important that you hear what Safi has to say about the United Nations World Food Program having their funding cut by 60%, which is going to have catastrophic consequences both for Syrians and other refugees around the world. This is going to be the major through line throughout this podcast. The international community is turning their back on refugees. Safi, can you start by telling us a little bit about yourself? Where in Syria are you from, and what was it like to grow up there?
I'm Safi Khamis, a dentist. Basically, I'm from Idlib, but I was born, raised, and studied in Aleppo. So I consider myself half Idlibi and half Alebian. I had a regular childhood like any child in this world. But during my teenage years, the Syrian revolution against Bashar al-Assad's regime started. I didn't hesitate to join. It was a turning point in my life, like many Syrians. The revolution had a significant impact on my personality. I learned a lot, such as facing injustice and oppression, living under siege, dealing with the loss of loved ones, and advocating for your case using all possible means. As Syrians, we went through unusual experiences. I'm no exception. I left Syria forcibly 3 years ago, but I'm still in touch with many friends and activists in different parts of Syria. Now, I work with all I can to advocate the Syrian cause, aiming for the freedom of the Syrian people and removal of Bashar al-Assad's regime.
I just want to say real quick, because I failed to mention it earlier to the listeners, all three of us, we've been working together at Hurriya, a news website focused on Syria. We put out English language articles about current developments in Syria and other related matters in the region, other parts of the world. And Safi has been a phenomenal writer at Hurriya.
Thank you, Sean.
You are like the real workhorse of Hurriya, bro, I gotta say.
Thank you so much, Poppy, for your effort.
I'm doing nothing. I'm trying to do my best. I believe that it is my duty.
So, Safi, before 2011, what were your thoughts about the Syrian regime that were and still under the rule of Bashar al-Assad? Did you, like, hear stuff as all of the Syrians heard before the revolution, like, walls have ears, the intelligence, you can't speak against the regime, the intelligence might hear you and take you and take your family. What's your point of view of Assad and his regime before the revolution?
Yeah, to be honest, I was like 16. You know, I was interested in playing football and nothing related to the politics at all. So at that time, I didn't know anything about politics and who is Hafez al-Assad or who is Bashar al-Assad and what about the regime, nothing at all. So when the Syrian revolution started, I started to know about politics and I started reading about the regime and like 80s and Hama, what happened in Hama and everything. So I was like teenager. I didn't think about that.
That is most teenagers. You know, whether it's Americans, Syrians, most people just, especially that age, just want to focus on fun or school. What is the humanitarian situation in Northwest Syria right now? How does aid reach people who live there?
We need to understand what the term Northwest Syria means. Northwest Syria is an area controlled by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is considered a terrorist organization internationally. It covers about half of Idlib and limited areas in Aleppo, Latakia, and Hama. The region hosts 3 million people, with almost half of them being displaced. The humanitarian situation in this area is very tough. There is a shortage of food, with around 4.1 million people needing help and 3.7 million facing food insecurity. In healthcare, more than half of the doctors and professionals in this area have left. In 2023, around 3.8 million people need medical care. The earthquake in February caused damage to healthcare facilities, and almost one third of them are now inactive. Healthcare workers also faced extra challenges like cholera and malnutrition. Concerning food, 4 out of every 5 people in this area don't have enough to eat. In July, WFP had to reduce aid due to funding shortages. Overall, the situation is tough, and people need support in areas like food and healthcare to improve. In northwest Syria, areas controlled by the Syrian opposition in places like Idlib, Aleppo, and Latakia are often attacked by the Syrian government and Russian forces. This happens even though there is supposed to be a reduction of hostilities according to an agreement made by Russia, Turkey, Iran in 2017. At the same time, a group called Syria Response Coordinators released a report about the situation there last October. The report said that there were a total of 640 attacks by Syrian and Russian forces in the region. The situation in northwest Syria can be considered catastrophic. I don't know if listeners can imagine themselves living in a crowded place with very tough economic conditions, and despite that, airstrikes keep taking the lives of many people. It's quite challenging to picture, especially if you are not Syrian or haven't experienced something similar.
Yeah, I mean, what you describe is really powerful. Can you give us some context about the United Nations World Food Program and what they do for Syria? How important is that aid for Syrians, especially in northwest Syria?
Okay, it's really important. The WFP warned last September that 24 million people were in danger or not having enough food. This led them to cut back on food help in many places around the world. In July, almost half of the people getting aid in Syria had their help stopped, according to the program. As I mentioned before, about 1.5 million people in northwest Syria live in really crowded camps, especially near the Turkish border in northern Idlib. Others are staying in old buildings, caves, or even among ancient ruins and old buses. These camps don't have enough basic stuff, and the people there mostly depend on food, medical help, and other support from international groups. This is super important because diseases are spreading, more people are poor, and prices are going up a lot. The WFP decision will really affect these camps. 3 years ago, I visited Atma camp. time doesn't allow me to describe the sense fully, but I can say that children, women, and elderly face many difficulties. Today, the situation is even worse. We must not forget that many cancer patients are struggling to receive treatment in Turkey. The WFP provides assistance through other local organizations such as Benafsaj, SAMA, SDI, SRD, GOL, ACTED, MARAM, and a lot of other local organizations.
Safi, I want to ask you something. What do you think the situation might look like after 6 months or maybe after a year of the aid being cut to the refugees?
It's so difficult because, you know, it's not about like we have just poor people. No, we have poor people, we have patients, we have a lot of, like, the situation is so complex. So I don't know the answer. And no one can expect, you know, because there is another, like, factors. For example, the pricing is raising up. Yeah, because it is so difficult, you know. Yeah. We can't, at least I can't.
It is a difficult but necessary question, and thank you so much for doing the best you can to answer it.
Don't thank me. Just I told you that I'm doing my duty. Just I feel that it is my duty. I'm doing nothing.
You do a lot, man. I mean, I'm sorry if it doesn't feel like it, but you do a lot. Seriously, I have met very few people who can write articles as fast as you do.
Not about how speed you are. It's about like maybe Subhi knows that I have a responsibility to write accurate information, and I don't like to say something from my brain or just talking like not accurate information. So it's so difficult. Like, we can answer that. We can answer that. But I need to search. I need to search, like, and do something to answer that. So, yeah.
So, searching the situation in the northwestern area, territories of Syria, even after searching, it might be, I don't know, I'm just thinking, it might be really hard to answer that question. Because there's no one like holding up. There's no government.
Yeah, exactly. No government and no like statics and nothing. And we have statics from some organizations, but it's not accurate.
Especially HTS that are holding those areas. So HTS. Are too not, according to my knowledge. You can't trust that organization. You can't trust them. As I heard on Twitter from a couple of people who are living in Idlib, that HTS does hold Syrian Turkish borders. Whenever a trade is about to go on, they might take like some percentage, just as the same as the regime does. So no one else in Idlib or in the northern areas of Syria, northern cities of Syria that are under HTS control can do any trade without HTS knowledge, according to what I heard. I might be wrong. They might be wrong. They might not be wrong. They might be correct. I don't know, but it makes sense in a way.
Yeah, exactly.
So eventually you can't predict the outcome. I mean, I'm sorry I asked you that question, but I needed to ask you that question because there's 2.5 million people who might be going to be in need for those food aid.
When did the WFP announce that they were cutting aid to Syria, and why did they make that decision?
The WFP said on December 4th, it won't be able to give food help in Syria from the beginning of next year because they don't have enough money. The program's boss, Yanni Sovanto, explained that they are getting 60% less money worldwide in 2023. This means they have to stop their war completely in Syria, but he said they will start new programs with other groups working in the area. Even though donor conferences promised more than $2 billion for this funding cycle, the program only got 30% of the total money they need. The team from Syria response coordinators said this big cut doesn't match the real needs of people in the region, and they are worried about the bad effects of these decisions to reduce help.
60%.
Yep, unfortunately.
Oh God. Is this because of like inflation? Is this because of like the economic impacts of Russia invading Ukraine? Why is this such a significant drop?
Like donor countries, they don't commit to their promises, like regarding funding humanitarian organizations. So, but this year, I don't know exactly why, but that's what happened.
So now they're saying that they're going to continue sending aid to a much smaller number of people in Syria now?
Yeah, exactly. Like the WFP said, they will keep helping families hit by emergencies and natural disasters all over the country. And they will do this with smaller and more specific emergency help. And of course, they will also keep helping young kids, pregnant and breastfeeding moms. But as I mentioned before, reducing any kind of help will be really bad for the people in Syria.
That's a terrible position for anybody to be in, whether it's the displaced people who need the aid or the people trying to aid the people with less and less resources as time goes on. I mean, if you don't have the money, you don't have the money. But I mean, I wish there was some way that we could keep sending aid to Syria without, say, cutting off aid to another country that also needs it, you know, like Gaza or the Congo, right?
Yeah, exactly. WFP, or not just WFP, all the international organizations that always says that we have funding shortages. So and that's because of, as I mentioned, the donor countries, they don't commit to their promises.
When the WFP cuts or reduces aid to Syria, what do you think are the chances we're going to see more and more refugees fleeing from Syria as a result?
We can expect that in a normal way, but nowadays the situation is different. Because the Syrian-Turkish borders, the Turkish military is shooting everyone trying to flee from Syria. For example, when we say Northwest Syria is a big prison, yeah, we don't lie. It is like big open prison. Because no one can flee from this area. This area has borders with Syrian regime, and people, of course, can't go to the areas under control Syrian regime, and they can't go to Turkey. And so they have no choices at all.
So I shared something on Hurriya. So it was December 12th, 5 or 6. Gendarme personnel who were hitting a Syrian at a border guarding point who tried to cross the borders to Turkey. So yeah, it is a pretty much difficult situation for the Syrians. And lastly, I want to add something. During the upcoming couple of months, February, January, you will see so many Syrians running away, passing from Turkey to Europe. The Syrian guys here are talking about the same thing. Everyone is waiting for the winter to fight down a bit to just try to take refuge from Turkey to Europe.
That's because the policies of Turkish government against Syria.
So for the organization's part, I want and Sally knows this because she has a couple of friends who are working at many humanitarian organizations. The humanitarian aids are being stolen. The organizations are stealing the humanitarian aid. Many organizations, Irish organizations, British organizations, American organizations, their branches here in Turkey, especially in Gaziantep and Şanlıurfa, those branches are run by Turkish people, maybe Syrian people, it doesn't matter. So many of them are stealing the humanitarian aid. For example, I am an employee at that organization, a contracted employee at that organization. I will work for 6 months. I will get paid monthly like $800, $900 in the dollar currency. They get paid in dollar currency. Especially in those organizations, an organization manager and maybe someone from his side manages those stuff. So they give the employees like maybe less than half of the salary, of the monthly salary, and they take the rest for their pocket. This is happening. This is a reality. The aid money are being stolen here in Turkey. I don't know much about the situation in Syria, and I pretty much guess that they are stealing aid money. But in Turkey, I can assure you 100% that some of it and a big part of it are being stolen.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm talking about Turkish authorities and the situation in Turkey. Turkish authorities started an operation to send Syrian refugees back to their homeland, claiming it to be a voluntary return to safe areas in northern Syria. The Ministry of Interior stated that over half a million Syrians returned voluntarily, while around 20,000 were forcibly deported due to security issues. People in northwest Syria, they have no choice. They have no choices at all.
Exactly, and I want to actually add up to the subject that those Syrians who are temporarily residing in Turkey as a refugees, as a temporary refugees, when they are being forcibly deported back to Turkey, when they are forcibly being deported back to northern Syria cities, many of those refugees do not have any relatives over there or friends. And they are living a very, very harsh conditions. Some of them are committing suicide, some of them committed suicide because they can't do anything. They can't cross back to Turkey by paying some smuggler. Can cost up to $4,000 at these times. And so many people are doing it. Not that so many people, but people are doing it. And guess what? The gendarme, personnel of the gendarme are taking those money. So those Syrians who are being forcibly deported back to Syria, they are living harsher situations more than the ones who are living in harsh situations citizens in Syria because they have nothing to do over there. Their families are in Istanbul or in any other Turkish city, but they are just without knowing it, they just got deported from Turkey. This crisis might indeed increase over the time, and if it will be increasing, it will increase at a very incredible pace.
Last thing we're going to close out on here. What could people around the world do to put pressure on politicians or non-governmental organizations to keep aid flowing into northwest Syria? What could the listeners do to help this situation?
We now need to work on multiple fronts, like raising awareness about Syria and the humanitarian situation there, just as you, Sean, do through your articles and podcasts. We also need to work on forming pressure groups to push donor countries to commit to their promises regarding funding humanitarian organizations. We can also contribute by donating to local humanitarian groups and organizations in northwest Syria. As I mentioned, we have Banafsaj, GOL, SDI, SRD. Because any type of support can make a significant difference. Each of us, from our own position, can help politically through the media or even by donating, and maybe we need to work on forming pressure groups to push donor countries to commit to their promises regarding funding humanitarian organizations, and maybe raising awareness about the humanitarian situation there.
That's a really important point. Like, I think something a lot of people might not realize going into this, especially if they don't know about the situation. If you see a headline that says World Food Program is cutting aid to Syria, a lot of people are going to come away with the impression that, oh, wow, the WFP are the bad guys in that situation. But the way that you describe it, Safi, with the context that you've brought to us, it's not the WFP who are the bad guy in the situation. It's the donor countries who aren't meeting their obligations, who aren't keeping their promises.
Exactly. Especially USA. Because USA reduced the aid for all the international organizations in Middle East. We have to, because a lot of people are suffering right now. When you are listening to this podcast or to this episode, a lot of people are suffering. Like, we are in the winter, and you know how much it is difficult to live in these camps without any kind of stuff or any kind of protection from winter and cold. We have to do something right now, and because the situation there is so catastrophic.
Safi, thank you so much for coming on and talk to us about this really depressing but really important subject. Subi, thanks so much for coming on, bro. It's depressing as hell, but like you said, Safi, we got to do whatever we can.
As of 2023, there are currently 110 million forcibly displaced people around the world, forced to leave their homes by war, persecution, human rights violations, natural disasters, and economic collapse. 62.5 million of them are quote-unquote internally displaced people, or IDPs, meaning they were forced to flee from one part of their country to another. Another 36.4 million people are refugees, meaning that they were forced to flee from one country to another. The only difference between IDPs and refugees is that the latter have crossed international borders, the former have not. An IDP camp and a refugee camp are functionally the same thing. People often use those words interchangeably. IDPs will often become refugees when dangerous conditions in their country persist or worsen, while countries hosting large populations of refugees are increasingly incentivized to prevent IDPs from crossing their borders. The number of forcibly displaced people around the world is currently at its highest since World War II. This has unfortunately been the case for about a decade, and the number of displaced people has consistently increased every year with the outbreak of new conflicts, while older ones persist with no end in sight. That's why this number just keeps going up year after year after year. This year, I found it particularly difficult to find up-to-date refugee statistics. Like, seriously, last year, all I had to do was Google top refugee-producing countries. And I would literally just find a list of them on Google. That's why I did, like, a top five last year. It was that easy. I found it with a simple Google search. But y'all, oh my god, it took, like, this time it took, like, hours of Googling. I had to, like, use clever wordplay in the Google search to even find the data necessary. I don't know what the hell is going on. I don't know if it's just because, like, Google is just a lot less useful than it used to be. I've heard a lot of people say that. Google's really taking a nosedive in terms of quality. But, like, it wasn't even just Google. Like, the damn United Nations websites. And by the way, that's another thing. There isn't just, like, one UN website where you can go find everything. There's, like, dozens of them. I don't know who manages which one. There's, like, they differ in quality. It's just a disorganized mishmash, like the United Nations in general. Like, I'm sorry. I want to love the UN. I know they perform a really valuable service in the world. But more recently, like, my God, their critics have a point. I mean, it is a highly dysfunctional organization. And it really shows with their websites. It really shows with just how damn hard it was to find current, up-to-date data about refugees. And look, let's be fair. This year has been an exception, okay? There's, like, new refugee crises going on. It's hard to keep track of it all. Things are a lot more in flux this year than they were, like, a year or two ago. I get that. I get it's going to take years for us to catch up with all the data, but, like, even still, like, there's some weird stuff going on, both with Google and the United Nations websites. It really did used to be a lot easier to research this last year. All right. Since this is a technically Syria-focused podcast, we'll start by talking about Syria. There are currently 6.5 million Syrian refugees around the world, and another 6.8 million people internally displaced within Syria. Although that number may have gone up by now. 15 million people across the country, at least 15 million, are in dire need of humanitarian aid after a decade of war, deprivation, and more recently, some of the worst earthquakes in living memory. Holy hell. That means two-thirds of the current population need assistance from the international community just to stay alive. This situation, along with the Assad regime's genocidal campaign against political opposition, is why millions of Syrians have fled to Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon. A far smaller number of Syrian refugees were able to resettle in Europe or the United States, despite the best efforts of anti-immigration hardliners. And before we move on to talking about other countries, I want to say real quick, we are currently working on a special about the February earthquakes. We're working on them right now. Subi and I have been interviewing people for months now, and we're hoping to have it out by this coming February to mark the one-year anniversary. So hopefully we can get it done in time. Next, Afghanistan. It is especially difficult to find reliable data about Afghan refugees today. And if you look it up on Google, you'll find a lot of articles that say 2.3 million people from Afghanistan have been forced to flee. But there are two problems with that statement. First of all, That refers to Afghans who have fled since the fall of the U.S.-backed government there in 2021. Secondly, those only count the registered refugees, as opposed to refugees with no documentation. Afghanistan has been in one continuous state of war after another since 1979. The total number of Afghan refugees around the world, including undocumented refugees, is probably closer to somewhere between 5.7 million, and it may even be as high as 8 million. I mean, in that case, we'd probably be talking about both the refugees who fled and the families they started afterwards, their kids who were born abroad. So it's a little complicated, but somewhere between 5.7 million to 8 million Afghan refugees live scattered around the world, with the vast majority of them currently reside in Pakistan and Iran. Unfortunately, though, these countries are becoming increasingly inhospitable to Afghans. This is partly due to worsening economic conditions and social unrest in both countries. But it also ties in with the fact that Pakistan, and to a lesser extent Iran, are allies of the Taliban, who covertly supported their war effort against the U.S.-led coalition. The Taliban wholeheartedly support the deportation of refugees back to Afghanistan, because a lot of those people fled from the Taliban. They would love to undo the brain drain they caused when every individual and skilled worker in the country tried to flee 2 years ago. And it would also lower the risk of anti-Taliban resistance groups organizing among the Afghan diaspora. Lastly, a lot of these refugees are on the Taliban's kill list for having criticized or otherwise openly opposed them. This is also coming at a time when 3.5 million people across Afghanistan remain internally displaced by ongoing conflict and a series of natural disasters that the new Taliban government were just woefully unprepared to address. Sending several million people back to Afghanistan against their will is guaranteed to turn today's humanitarian disaster into a full-blown catastrophe. Pakistan announced earlier this year that at least 1.7 million undocumented Afghan refugees would be deported starting in November. This process has already begun. Iran, meanwhile, has literally banned Afghan refugees or immigrants from living, working, or even traveling through 16 of the country's 31 provinces. Seriously, they passed this law just a few weeks ago. Now, Afghan citizens are now literally forbidden from even setting foot or driving through more than half of Iran's provinces. More than half of the country is now off limits to Afghans. Unbelievable. It won't be much of a stretch after this for Iran to follow Pakistan's example and initiate the mass deportation of refugees back to Afghanistan. There, those people will face prolonged suffering and probably a slow death from starvation, malnutrition, dehydration, if they aren't tortured and killed by the Taliban first. I'm not sure how to transition organically from that, so we're just going to transition unorganically. Consider this a concentrate transition. Next, we have Ukraine. This is a complicated one because the number of refugees leaving Ukraine is actually similar to that of returning refugees. That's nothing like the last two we just talked about. Unlike Syrians or Afghans, Ukrainian refugees have by and large voluntarily returned after their government managed to halt the Russian advance and gradually began recapturing territory seized in early 2012. But keep in mind, there are still people who are deciding to leave the country as the conflict continues. Right now, somewhere between 5.9 to 6.3 million Ukrainian refugees are estimated to be living in different European countries, while another 5 million Ukrainians remain internally displaced, and more than 17 million are currently in urgent need of humanitarian assistance. This situation is admittedly less dire than that of Syrians and Afghans, but there is potential for this to change in the very near future. Ukraine has held out against Russia's invasion thanks to significant quantities of aid provided by the international community. We've already talked in this episode about how governments all over the world are turning their backs on refugees. In Ukraine's case, you've got an allied nation under attack while politicians in the U.S. and elsewhere muse about cutting off the support we're sending them. Cutting off economic and military aid to Ukraine will enable Russia to go back on the offensive, take over more Ukrainian territory, and displace more people, both internally and across international borders. Keep an eye on this situation. It could deteriorate rapidly. Now we turn to Venezuela. Around 7.7 million Venezuelans are estimated to have fled the country since 1999, although the vast majority of them left after 2015. This coincided with a sharp rise in authoritarianism, economic distress, and violent crime. Venezuela is an outlier on this list because there isn't a war going on there, although the murder rate there has definitely risen to a level that rivals countries experiencing war. This goes to show that conflict is not the only thing that can render a country uninhabitable. War is one, but not the sole motivating factor. For literally millions of people to uproot their lives and seek out a new life abroad, sometimes even crossing borders on foot to seek asylum in neighboring Colombia, or even as far away as the United States. Now, do me a favor. Look at a globe, or just Google a map of the world. Look at how far away Venezuela is from the U.S. How many countries are located between them? That's how far some Venezuelans have literally walked just to find a place where there aren't shortages of food and medicine, where the government won't torture you or murder you for protesting against those shortages, somewhere you stand a decent chance of being hired fair and square for a decent job, not because you know the right people, but because you're the most qualified for the position. More than 7 million people, the largest refugee population in the world, outnumbering even Syrians and Afghans, have uprooted their lives and said goodbye to their families. This wouldn't be happening if the Venezuelan government hadn't shown them time and time again that there was no hope for positive change while Nicolas Maduro remains in power. Honestly, I'm not sure if things will get better or worse after Maduro is out of power. But right now, things are terrible, and that dude has proven that he sucks as a head of state. Like, for God's sake, Maduro just threatened to invade and annex most of Guyana like a month ago. Publicly said he was going to do some straight-up evil dictator shit, until a mixture of bribes and threats from the international community convinced Maduro to pursue a diplomatic deal instead. And who the hell knows if this will work out in the long run or not. You might have also noticed that we didn't mention any IDPs this time. That's because there pretty much are none in Venezuela, or at least they're few and far between. A country in a state of civil war generally has regions that are safer than others. That's why some displaced people will choose to stay in their countries as IDPs. Venezuela's socioeconomic crisis is a nationwide catastrophe we really haven't seen anywhere else, at least not in the 21st century. That's why we're talking about 7 million refugees in this case, the largest such group in the world. Next, we turn again to South Sudan. If you heard the last Christmas special, you'll probably remember that long segment we did on this country and its refugees. This is a more of your typical, maybe even stereotypical, refugee crisis. 2.4 million refugees have fled the country, and another 2.3 million people remain internally displaced because of a terrible civil war that started in 2013 and finally subsided in 2020. Now the country appears to be in a state of tense, anxious peace, typical of a country that has recently experienced civil conflict. A new election is scheduled for next year, their first one since before the Civil War. Only time will tell if this will be a return to normal life, or if the current peace will collapse when the losing candidate refuses to accept the election results. All of this is to say, that it's understandable why people who have fled from South Sudan are reluctant to return, even though the war is technically over now. Unfortunately, we also have another Sudan to talk about, you know, North Sudan, or, if you will, the original Sudan. I know, you've heard of Sudan, you've heard of Sudanese refugees, you've heard of wars and atrocities going on there since, like, 2004. You've been hearing about it for 20 years, I get it. But this year, things really took a turn for the worst.
The fighting in Sudan is a power struggle. It's a power struggle between two men.
Khartoum is a city burning with thick plumes of smoke and violence everywhere. A power struggle between Sudan's armed forces and its rival faction, the Rapid Support Forces, has turned residential streets into war zones. Not even the children are spared. The smallest coffins are the heaviest. Last month, the state-run Al Magoma Orphanage said nearly 70 children had died of fever and starvation, including two dozen babies.
On April 15, people in Sudan woke up to the sounds of explosions, artillery shells, and airstrikes. Two army generals who came to power in a 2019 coup and shared it for 4 years decided to oust one another. They said it was the only way to achieve a better future for the country. But many believe it's a personal power struggle. The two sides seem to have underestimated each other's strength. The war, which was initially supposed to be short, has dragged on for months. Rights groups and the UN accused RSF fighters of committing atrocities, including mass ethnic cleansing, rape and abductions in the city of Jenina, capital of West Darfur. The war has forced up to 3 million people from their homes. 700,000 have fled to neighboring countries.
Honestly, if it weren't for political reasons, we would be calling this the third Sudanese civil war right now. It started off as a coup attempt. Then one side tried to eradicate the other side, i.e. the people who plotted the coup against them, and it just devolved into a bloody, stalemated slugfest all over the country. This year also saw the resumption of genocidal massacres in Darfur. At least 1,000 people from the Masalit ethnic group are confirmed to have been killed since last April. At least 1,000 people from the Masalit ethnic group are confirmed to have been killed since last April. So look, I know you've heard about Sudan and Darfur before, and you're probably sick of hearing about it, but the fact is, this year has been an exceptionally bloody year for Sudan. If you hear people complaining about Sudanese refugees in particular, keep this in mind. Don't let compassion fatigue overtake you. In addition to a new war making everything else, an estimated 800,000 people in Sudan face imminent risk of starvation due to cuts in funding from the UN World Food Program. So it's not only Syrians facing dire consequences from these budget cuts. These cuts will have a dire impact on the most vulnerable people in every corner of the world. Up next, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Yeah, I'm sure you've heard of this one too. A large, resource-abundant country that has been racked by multiple civil wars since the 1990s. A lot of small-scale, simultaneous conflicts going on in different regions all at once. But seriously, there's a reason I'm mentioning the Congo now when I didn't in previous Christmas specials. 2023 saw a massive escalation in fighting between the government and rebels on the eastern border, which entailed a sharp rise in atrocities against civilians, as both sides take out their frustrations against defenseless locals. Hundreds of people have been murdered, countless others raped and tortured, plus thousands of homes burned to the ground. Tens of thousands of people have grabbed whatever belongings they can carry before fleeing for their lives, bringing the total number of internally displaced Congolese people up to 5 million. There are also currently over 1 million Congolese refugees scattered across the world, And that number will inevitably go up as violence in the Eastern Congo continues to intensify. Next, oh God. Next, we're talking about Gaza. Oh, man. This is probably the last thing you want to hear about right now. Whether you're someone who passionately supports Israel or someone who passionately supports the Palestinian people, this topic just makes everyone angry and miserable. I'm not going to drone on and on about all the killing, all the death, all of the innocent people who've been brutalized, because you're seeing and hearing about that literally everywhere else right now. Instead, we're going to take a look at the people who've been displaced by the current war. More than 1 million people have been forcibly displaced since October 7th, according to the United Nations. Quick caveat, a lot of people accuse the UN of bias one way or another when it comes to Israel and Palestine. I'm sorry, but they're the best numbers we have at this moment. Around 1.2 million people have been displaced by relentless bombing and ongoing fighting throughout the Gaza Strip. That's more than half of Gaza's entire population. More than half. Imagine more than half of your hometown losing their homes. I don't know, like a tornado or a hurricane blows through, something like that. Displaced people in Gaza, who now make up half the population or more, have fled to recently constructed IDP camps where tents with barely any insulation are their only shelter from the winter. Food, clean water, and medicine are also scarce. The latter two are contributing to an epidemic of gastroenteritis, aka stomach flu, and other waterborne illnesses, which the few doctors present have nowhere near enough resources to adequately treat. Keep in mind, these people are cold, they're hungry, and they've experienced an unimaginable level of stress every moment of every day for the last 2.5 months. That's going to wreck your immune system. And for people who had pre-existing medical conditions prior to this October, oh, it's been bad. Really bad. Really, really bad. People with diabetes, cancer, heart disease, or other conditions that require daily medication are running out. These are innocent people I'm talking about. I'm not talking about able-bodied Hamas terrorists who are fighting the IDF right now. I'm talking about innocent people who are dying from preventable deaths. And that's to say nothing about people who are recently injured by Israeli bombardment, many of whom now have infected wounds due to a lack of antibiotics and other medical treatment. We're going to finish this by examining a group of people who have recently suffered the worst genocide you've never heard of. These are the Rohingya people. You've probably heard of Myanmar, aka Burma. You've probably heard that country is run by a military dictatorship, which subjugates the country's ethnic minorities and routinely uses mass murder and mass rape to terrorize these populations into compliance. You've probably heard all of that before. You've probably heard of the Karen people, or the Shan people, or the Wa people suffering this ill treatment. But the Rohingya are unique in that for what little attention Myanmar receives in international media, their treatment of the Rohingya receives almost none of it. Their plight has been described by some as a forgotten genocide, or even, quote, the crisis the world is ignoring, unquote. And I gotta be honest, y'all, that also includes me. I am part of the problem here. I have ignored the Rohingya refugee crisis in my last couple Christmas specials. And I don't even have a good reason to give y'all. Last year, I was doing the top 5 worst refugee crises around the world. But this year, with the World Food Program having their budget cut by 60%, I couldn't justify continuing to ignore the refugee populations I haven't mentioned in the past. The Rohingya have been subjugated, massacred, and forcibly displaced multiple times over like 2 or 3 centuries. And they've been targeted mainly for 2 reasons. First, they are an ethnic minority who speak their own language, which makes them suspects in the eyes of Burmese supremacists. Look, basically every authoritarian regime in the world, you have ethnic supremacists. They just go hand in hand. You can't really have an authoritarian state that isn't racist to one degree or another. But secondly, the Rohingya are almost entirely Muslim in a country where a majority of the population are Buddhist. Okay, some really important context here. A lot of people, especially white guys, yes, I am calling out my own people here. A lot of people, especially white people, have this assumption that Islam is somehow an inherently more violent religion than, say, Buddhism. You know, if you talk to enough people in the U.S., again, mostly white people, you talk to enough people in the United States, most of them will say, well, yeah, of course Islam's more violent than Buddhism. And I gotta say, y'all, nothing disproves this notion more thoroughly than the Rohingya genocide. I have watched videos of Buddhist monks chopping people's heads off with machetes. And the unfortunate soul who got their head chopped off in that video was a Rohingya Muslim. Just let that sink in for a moment. Buddhist monks decapitating Muslims and commanding their fellow Buddhists to do the same. Now, does this mean that Buddhism is an inherently violent religion? Does this mean that all Buddhists are exactly this way? Hell no, most of them are not. What this means is that Myanmar, aka Burma, has a serious problem with Buddhist extremism. And this itself is a byproduct of the Burmese military junta using exclusionary identity politics to solidify their hold on power and to keep their country's minority populations under heel. These videos of Buddhist monks decapitating Muslims started to circulate online in 2012, coinciding with a rise in intercommunal violence between the Rohingya and the Buddhist Rakhine people, who are culturally and linguistically much closer to the Burmese people and the ruling junta. Recently, evidence has emerged that the government very likely orchestrated the unrest in 2012 as an excuse to pursue a premeditated campaign of ethnic cleansing. The Rohingya at this point were already living under a system of discrimination that some have described as apartheid. They've all been denied Burmese citizenship under a law passed in 1982, turning them into one of the world's largest stateless populations. This denial of citizenship in their country of birth also meant they were denied access to adequate education, healthcare, and employment. They were already as marginalized as a group of people could possibly be when Myanmar's military junta decided it was time to start slaughtering the Rohingyas again. This resurgence of violence prompted tens of thousands of Rohingya people to flee across the border to Bangladesh by 2015. But while the government of Myanmar was stoking intercommunal violence, there was also something going on that many people viewed as a sign of hope. Aung San Suu Kyi is a politician who gained worldwide renown for openly opposing the junta, to the point where she earned a Nobel Peace Prize while spending 15 years under house arrest as a political prisoner. She was finally released in 2010 and immediately established herself as the leading opposition figure in Myanmar's political system, spearheading the country's slow transition from a military dictatorship to something with a semblance of democracy. This culminated in her being elected state counselor, basically the prime minister, in 2016. A lot of people, mostly naive Westerners like myself had very high hopes for Myanmar at this point, especially with regard to their treatment of the Rohingya people. Unfortunately, despite all of her high-minded talk about democracy and nonviolent activism, Aung San Suu Kyi also turned out to be as racist as your average boomer. She did care about freedom and democracy for her fellow ethnic Burmese. Her views on the Rohingya, on the other hand, were exactly the same as the junta she had opposed. That's why Aung San Suu Kyi had no objections whatsoever when the military decided to go mask off and initiate a full-scale genocide. Locals acting covertly on the government's orders were replaced with soldiers who had orders to kill every man, gang rape every woman, and execute every child, sometimes by throwing them into open fires, while destroying every Rohingya village. Aung San Suu Kyi didn't bat an eye while the military of Myanmar, known as the Tatmadaw, committed not one, but two campaigns of genocide in 2016 and 2017. Quick side note, I was against the 2021 coup d'etat in Myanmar, but I also have zero sympathy for Aung San Suu Kyi. As far as I'm concerned, her getting overthrown and sent to prison by the junta was karma for her role in the genocide. Now let's look at the numbers. At least 25,000 Rohingya people were massacred in these 2 years alone, while 18,000 women and girls, very young girls, were subjected to sexual violence. Keep in mind, these are conservative estimates. The real number is very likely much higher. This prompted hundreds of thousands more to flee for their lives, most of whom crossed the border into Bangladesh, which was basically the entire point of the genocide. Genocide is not always about exterminating a group of people entirely. Genocide can mean exterminating part of a group of people. And normally, when you're exterminating part of a group of people, men, women, and children, indiscriminately, the point is to terrify the rest of them into leaving, which is, genocide is often a means of ethnic cleansing, the situation we're talking about here. Today, the Rohingya are among the most desperate and downtrodden people living in Southeast Asia. 965,000 Rohingya are stuck in Bangladesh, with 600,000 of them residing in the world's largest refugee camp. Yes, the largest one. Kuta Palong has all of the squalid conditions of any refugee or IDP camp, like the ones in Gaza we just mentioned. But they also have the added complication of Southeast Asia's weather and wildlife. Monsoon season is a yearly ordeal for Rohingya refugees, while snakes, tigers, and even elephants pose a daily risk to life and limb. The elephants are exceptionally dangerous for the refugees. They are easily agitated, and they're large enough to crush a human being to death with ease. Not only that, just one elephant on a rampage, let alone a herd of them, which happens sometimes, they can smash through the refugees' makeshift shelters. These hellish conditions have compelled some of the refugees to leave the camps in search of employment elsewhere, during which they are often preyed upon by human traffickers. The Rohingya refugees are stuck in a no-win situation that continues to get worse every year, especially now with the World Food Program cutting aid to refugee populations around the world. This podcast isn't meant as a suffering Olympics. Each situation we discussed is different. They have differing factors and complications, but they're all relevant. And ultimately, displacement is displacement. Being rendered homeless and forced to flee from your country of birth is one of the worst things anyone can ever experience. And now that's happening to more people today than at any other point since World War II. While the organizations tasked with keeping them alive are given fewer and fewer resources. Doing more with less is not an option when people are starving to death. There's a worsening trend going on all over the world where governments, or just people in general, are turning their back on displaced people or unhoused people or homeless people, whatever you want to call them. In my country, increasing inflation and cost of living has coincided with a sharp rise in hatred of homeless people and hatred of immigrants crossing our southern border. Too many of us buy into the idea that everything will be just fine as long as all of the homeless are arrested and dragged out of our sight by the police. So many people are more concerned with keeping their neighborhoods looking pretty than whether or not other humans have food, shelter, or other necessities that we take for granted every single second of every day. Atomizing ourselves, turning inward, and only serving ourselves while leaving everyone else to fend for themselves is not the answer. We've been trying to do that for years. We've been trying this for decades even, and it's only made this problem worse. This Christmas, while you're enjoying a holiday meal with your family and having the time of your life, either opening presents or watching your kids open them, try to keep in mind that there are refugees and internally displaced people all over the world, as well as homeless people in your city or town who couldn't even imagine the comfort and joy you're experiencing right now. Lastly, if listening to this podcast was as soul-crushing for you to listen as it was for me to write and record it, I've got a happy, lighthearted one to suggest for you. We here at What Happened to Syria are putting out a bonus Christmas episode for our subscribers on Patreon, examining Christian communities in Syria and their Christmas traditions. If you need some holiday cheer to help you cope with gazing into the abyss of human misery, please consider going to our Patreon page and signing up for $3 a month. Thank you for listening to What Happened to Syria, a podcast about the country, the people, and their impact on the wider world since 2011. Follow us on Twitter at SyriaPod. That's at capital S-Y-R-I-A capital P-O-D at SyriaPod, so you can stay up to date with future episodes. You can email us at whathappenedtosyriapodcast@gmail.com. It's literally just the name of the podcast with the word podcast added to it @gmail.com. No capitalizations, one word, etc., etc. We encourage anyone to reach out to us if you think we got a detail wrong or if you have information relevant to the topics we discuss. If you are Syrian, part of the Syrian diaspora, or have otherwise been personally impacted by events in Syria since 2011, please reach out to us. We'd love to have you on the show. If you like what you heard and want to support future episodes, please consider supporting us on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/whathappenedtosyria to support us for as little as $1 a month. You can access bonus episodes for just $3 a month and join our Discord server for $5. You can also get fan-requested content and a shout-out in each episode when you join as a VIP patron for $20. Shout-out to our patrons Jaeger DePato, My Unique Mikkonen, and Sean Cummings. Hey, we got another Sean now. That's awesome. Thank you to all of our listeners. I'm Sean Hastings, the creator and host of What Happened to Syria. Merry Christmas, happy holidays. You'll be hearing a lot more from us very soon.